the food system is not just about people consuming, but it's also about land use. It's about saving the natural environment. It's about greenhouse gases going around the world. It's about how we can make our cities better and more sustainable.
This is Civios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
In this episode, I'm talking with Fernando Berga, an assistant professor in the Master of Urban and Regional Planning program at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. He is a community-engaged scholar who focuses on urban planning and its intersection with immigration, equity, and food systems. We'll be talking with him today about his current work that explores the connection between food access and transportation with immigrant communities in both urban and rural Minnesota. Thank you, Fernando, for coming here and talking with us about this. I'd like to find out more about why you began to focus on food systems specifically.
Thank you for the invitation, Kate. To answer your question, I came to the realm of food systems because I was really interested in immigration when I came to Minnesota to start working here as a faculty member. And I immediately was curious about where people worked and lived. I found very rapidly that immigrants, specifically Latino immigrants, make part of the labor that provides us with the food that we eat every day, and that became a strong connection. And from there, I started to focus on other issues. There was an emergent food systems public policy apparatus that was emergent and continues to evolve in Minnesota through the Minnesota Food Charter, the Food Charter Network, documents such as the Food Access Planning Guide, which focused specifically on people of color and underrepresented communities and how can they access food. So that became another platform for me. And lastly, my own personal awareness from my own experience, my own family, people that I know who have a lot of health problems related to food. As you may know, as others may know, Latinos suffer from diabetes as well as other chronic issues related to food. So these factors combine for me to start to focus on food.
Throughout your work, you talk about the idea of foodscape. So what constitutes a person's foodscape?
The term is a new term that has emerged specifically in the social sciences in fields such as anthropology and sociology. A foodscape essentially is a metaphor to think about your landscape of food. And it's important to conjure this imagination because what it does is that it allows us to imagine and see the world through the way that we consume and produce food. Specifically, a foodscape is where you go to get food. Groceries, supermarkets, restaurants, urban gardens, and also a deep understanding and consideration of the practices that you carry out to get to these places, to engage these places, how you get there, what are the challenges that you may encounter as you go there. It may involve also really clear understanding of place and space as markers and dividers of the foodscape. And essentially, it allows us to have a category that we can use in order to imagine food as a central aspect of our lives and cities.
So with that background, can you talk more specifically about how that is a part of your project and share a little bit about how you organized this project? And I know that you worked in both urban and rural areas. So talk a little bit about how similar, different those two areas are.
For sure. As I mentioned, when I arrived to Minnesota, I was concerned and looking for questions that dealt with equity and also which intersected with immigration, specifically as subfields within the urban planning field. And I became aware and participated in the ongoing debates and conversations that had to do with food access statewide and also at the metropolitan level and in rural areas. There has been immense and really interesting work that has been carried out by policymakers throughout the state considering food access as a very important topic in the lives of people. And in those conversations, I quickly identified that there was a deep understanding and need to connect and do outreach with communities of color. So understanding the opportunity that I brought myself as a Latino man with my own cultural capital to be able to go to these places and ask people what they think, need, wonder about their foodscape, I started to engage in that path. It was through partnerships with the University of Minnesota Extension, where I am also a specialist working through civic vitality, and also with partnerships with Family Resilience, which is another unit within Extension, that what I was able to identify the groups and the people that provided me with the capacity to carry out the research that I did. Specifically, to address this in more detail, I am a qualitative researcher. So I go out in the field and I talk to people about what they do and how they imagine the world in relationship to their practices. And then I gather that data, which is qualitative data, and I come up with an understanding of themes, categories, what is also called grounded theory, which is theorizing from the ground up to understand how people actually live and how policy systems basically engage them or not. So it was with that spirit and ethos that I did a lot of focus group research. I did a lot of surveys, which I can go into detail, and I also developed a participatory mapping technique. These three elements make part of the research methodology, which also encountered a set of evolutions as I encountered the field. As when you go out to the field, you identify new opportunities and constraints. The main question I was asking was, how do people get to culturally relevant and healthy foods? Which was an essential and key question derived from a review of the literature. And that evolved into new scopes. As I mentioned, I went into the field and identified new opportunities.
So one of the findings in your research is that those immigrants in the metro region rely on public transportation. And in your conversations with them, they cited a strong perception around safety when they take public transportation. And that seems to be such an important part of foodscape. So can you talk a little bit more about that aspect of it?
As you may know, and others may know who hear this podcast, being able to get to places becomes a really important factor in how we experience our foodscape. And specifically for Latino immigrants who do not have access to driver's license, public transit in the metro region becomes a really important facilitator in getting to food access points. Essentially, what I find through my research is that there is fear with regards to how people are perceived when they are in public transit. There's also fear of strangers, other passengers, other people who may be coming in the bus. Mostly women are the individuals who encounter this fear, and this obviously can be generalized, I think, to other demographic groups, not just Latina women. But it also, Latina women end up being the ones that are doing the shopping, carrying the bags, having their children with them when they go out and do the grocery shopping, as well as going to other places to get food. And when they use public transit, they have to encounter all these factors that really places a lot of stress on them and also hinders their capacity to buy food and do everything else that you need to do during the day. Because it's not just getting food, it's coordinating where your child is dealing with finances to being able to get the bus, is scheduling. So these types of situations really start to spillage into other aspects of everyday life, which become contingent on the foodscape.
What I'd like you to do now is to say more about how you designed the method for this study.
The way that I designed the method of the study focused on really being able to gather rich qualitative data. So one key aspect of being able to do this was access. I had to be able to meet people where they are for a period of time and develop a data collection approach that would ensure that there's no bias that gets developed at hand, or at least that bias is reduced as much as possible in my engagements with them. Another aspect was to ensure that every time I went out and did one of these workshops, that I could be able to reproduce the instruments in the same way over and over again. And these are just sort of like the essential methodological aspects, but there's also logistical aspects to this, which involve traveling, going to rural Minnesota and in the metro region in certain locations, coordinating with folks out there, carrying out specific things such as stipends and foods. These are the usual things that go into the development of qualitative research. I started with focus groups because that represented an essential component of qualitative research. From the focus groups, I developed graphic surveys, and I named them graphic surveys specifically because they had a strong graphic component so that people could actually look at them and visualize them as much as they filled out their content. And then I ended up with a participatory mapping exercise, which was a cognitive mapping. There's a long tradition in urban planning and urban design that dates back several decades that looks at how people experience and navigate and how they understand their world and how they identify locations, monuments, to be able to get to places. So I use that mapping technique in order to consider how people feel as they move through their landscape and come up with key categories, key emotional categories that would in many ways start to link how they experience place to notions of affect, notions of trauma, notions of hindrance that they may experience as they move through their rural and urban environments. These three instruments or approaches were complemented, so they represented workshops, which essentially were devised in order to correspond to each other and build from each of the steps. The focus group allowed people to have an open, facilitated conversation about their foodscapes and how they get to culturally relevant foods. That started to engage them with a set of ideas, which then could be refined in more detail quantitatively in the graphic surveys. And from there, we went into the more sort of like experimental research design, which involved the participatory mapping techniques. Together, the three types of approaches or instruments combine in order to relate to each other and also consider the ways that these categories work together as they evolve and emerge from the data. There's another step also, which is spatial analysis, which I'm still looking at. That's outside of the field work, but that involves taking the data that we have, looking at destinations, geocoding them in geographic information systems, and then identifying the patterns of accessibility, which involve how long it takes and how much it costs for people to get to places in rural and urban areas. But this is derived from the qualitative data then being coded into the mapping work to come up with these new representations of geographies.
Throughout your work, you call out and reference culturally relevant foods. I want you to talk about why that is important.
For sure. So culturally relevant foods are the foods that we all like to eat in many ways for different reasons, right? Sometimes they are foods that make us feel happy. They give us memories of our childhood. If you're an immigrant, you want to eat food that reminds you of home, or a food that allows you to engage in a practice with other members of a community that gives you a sense of identity, a sense of culture, a sense of place. We all do these things. We all have favorite foods, foods that our parents, grandparents, our communities have, in a sense, given us as heritage. And believe it or not, they're very important for us in terms of how we self-identify and where we consume. So the culture relevant food is also key, because one of the things that I find out is that not all the culturally relevant foods may be the healthiest food per se, or perhaps in the way that we immigrate to the U.S. or to other countries, we may lack access to the key ingredients that provide us with those foods that we recall. So we may substitute ingredients, or we may engage new practices which are not based on our own cultures, which then start to change our diets and start to change the way we eat and our relationship to food. This is, a matter of fact, a very important topic that emerged also through the work that I did, because there was a keen awareness from the mothers in particular on how to give and teach their kids to eat healthy foods. But obviously, there were sometimes issues that had to do with income, with access to groceries, and these types of challenges that prevented them to be able to get healthy foods or culturally relevant foods. Therefore, they sometimes had to cheat, as they would say, which is to go to McDonald's and have a burger, which would save them time and energy to be able to have dinner on the plate.
How does this research intersect with the larger urban planning field as a whole?
The food systems planning topic is a fairly, it's not so new. It's been around for about 20 years. The first literature on food systems started to emerge around the year 2000. And it was sort of like a huge ripple on the pond of planning, because we started to have a different type of conversation in relationship to how we conceive and plan our cities. It is still an evolving topic. It's a new topic that requires a lot of attention, because we are realizing, we become much more aware that the food system is not just about people consuming, but it's also about land use. It's about saving the natural environment. It's about greenhouse gases going around the world. It's about how we can make our cities better and more sustainable. So we're becoming much more aware of food systems, as well as other types of topics within planning that become really important. However, you know, planning still is resistant, right, to change, as any discipline is. And we have planning systems, which are the big types of subfields: housing, transportation, parks, which are starting to engage food systems planning as a little brother, in a sense, but still require more attention, because, you know, they're established, they're focused on specific methodologies and outputs, where food still is something novel, or we don't really know how to measure that, or we don't really know how to plan for that. So what's interesting in Minnesota is that we are a bit on the crux of this. We have a strong planning system in the metro region, and there's traditions of planning in rural areas. There's also a long tradition of agricultural practices in the state. So a lot of these things start to intersect, and they become really fascinating to explore and to study. Much work remains, though.
And so part of what you've done when designing your method is you've paid a lot of attention of the importance of the role of qualitative data collection in urban planning to ensure that the voices of the communities are heard.
The reason why I focus on that specifically was because, to put it bluntly, when I started to go to many of these meetings and events that involved talking about food and talking about disparities and considering policy making, there was a lot of discussion about outreach. Everybody wants to do outreach. Everybody wants to capture the stories. Everybody identifies the imperative of doing this, but nobody does it. And I think it's because a lot of people who are doing this fascinating work are part of institutional structures that may prevent them from actually doing this work, which may be innovative, it may be risky, it may take more time and energy, it involves relationship building, there may not be staffing, there may not be funding, it may be political given the context. So I quickly realized that, you know, this is something that is important, and I think that there is a place for the voice of underrepresented communities in this table, no pun intended, so that there can be a different way of thinking about this. And with that said, so that we can develop rigorous qualitative data collection approaches, so that we also do not just tokenize or simply reduce the complex stories of immigrants and other folks to simple catchphrases, but something that is much more complex and interesting. In that way, then, complementing the other data findings and policy frames that start to guide the work of policymakers.
Fernando, to wrap this all up, what are the policy implications of your work that is the connection between food access and transportation? What are the policy implications?
For sure. So there are many different ways to think about this, and I'm still evolving in my own thinking about what is it that this all means. The first main takeaway is that qualitative research can provide the current methodologies that we have in planning with additional data and information as to how to plan. This is not a novel concept. I think we all talk about it and we all want to do it. But as I mentioned before, it's hard to do it because it involves thinking about the research design. So one of the contributions that I have is an actual research design on how to do qualitative data collection with these populations in rural and urban Minnesota. And that's something that I'm really proud of. Besides the qualitative methodological aspect, there is this notion of actually engaging communities to be able to form partnerships that are long-lasting and evolving. Currently, we have policies which are important and useful. I will name one. The Food Access Planning Guide, for example, is a key policy. And the Food Access Planning Guide looks at the intersection of transportation and planning, as well as other categories such as land use, for example, and housing. But the guide is very normative. It assumes a very particular notion of who the actor is, usually a person who owns property and can deliberate in front of City Hall to be able to produce influence in decision-making in regards to food systems policy. So I'm saying that this is a great policy, but at the same time, there are many people who may be part of a community or our foodscape, our statewide foodscape, who may not be able to do that. So the qualitative kit or approach allows us to forge new bridges to be able to elevate those voices. And then more specifically, there are key findings that have to do with how people live in rural and urban areas and how they relate to their food. One of the really interesting findings for me was that this notion of micro-migrations every weekend in rural areas where you have numbers of people in specific communities traveling to the strip mall, the large strip mall that is on the edge of a larger town, like a Target, to be able to get their food, but also partake in buying things and seeing others and hanging out with family members. And this was really fun and interesting to find out in some of the focus group that I did. People talked about how sometimes there really isn't sort of like a public space or that much social life in their community, but they see each other at the Target that's located in Rochester, right? So it's interesting to think about how public life can happen in other locations due to food and access to things, but it is something that happens given the dynamics in rural Minnesota. And in the metro region, some of these more specific issues that have to do with how can we come up with better services for public transit, which may not only be about Latino immigrants, it may be about other groups also that may be experiencing similar circumstances for different reasons. Better programs and better services, better education so that people can become aware on how to get culturally relevant and healthy foods, but also how to feel safe as they do it. So there's a lot of work there that still is evolving that I'm gathering from the data that I can hopefully supply eventually.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Civios, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit civios.umn.edu.